This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of November 16, 2015. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated. We're going to talk this week about some of the things that have been happening. Now, appears to be that D.C. and the courts are kind of slowing down as we approach the holidays here, so things aren't happening quite as quickly as they were there for a while. We have a few things to talk about this week that have gone on that the IRS has released, and as well as one significant court case we want to discuss here that came down to us this week. So let's go ahead and start here first with an IRS notice. The first issue this week will be the IRS issued notice 2015-77 on November 9th. What it does is extend relief for those who received funds from the hardest hit fund to subsidize their mortgage payment, as well as the reporting for lenders who have payments that are coming in from that fund on mortgages when they report their 1098s. Now, this relief was originally given in Notice 2011-14 to last for a short period of time, was extended by Notice 2013-7 through last year, and now it's going to be extended through 2017 by this new Notice 2015-77. What happens in this case, if you have a taxpayer who received funds from a state housing agency, from the hardest hit funds, basically they were given a subsidy to be able to continue to pay their mortgage payment. Now, what happens in this case, for the taxable years from 2010 through 2017, a homeowner is going to be allowed to deduct on his or her federal income tax return the lesser of the sum of all the payments on the home mortgage that the homeowner actually makes during a taxable year to the mortgage servicer or the state housing, the housing administration of the state, or the sum of the payments, the amount shown on Form 1098, the mortgage interest date for the mortgage interest received, real property taxes, and mortgage insurance premiums. So essentially, we're going to cap it at that. We have to take a look at the payment you actually made, and the assumption is going to be that those payments first went to pay the interest and to pay the property taxes and to pay the mortgage insurance premiums if they're deductible. So basically, our limit on deduction will be based on the lesser of those two items. Now, the other side of this is safe harbor basically applies if the homeowner meets all the requirements to deduct the home mortgage interest on the loan and to deduct the property taxes, and it participates in the state program, which the program payments could be used to apply, could be used to pay interest on the home mortgage. Now, the information return relief for the mortgage companies is basically as follows, continues through. So they will not assert penalties. The IRS will not assert penalties against the mortgage servicer that reports on Form 1098 payments received under that program as long as they notify the homeowner that the amounts reported on the Form 1098 are overstated because they include government subsidy payments. As well, they will not assert penalties against any state housing administration for failing to file and furnish Form 1098 for 2011 through 2017 if they provide the homeowner and the IRS with a statement that basically, one, sets forth the homeowner's name and taxpayer ID number, the amount of payments the state agency made to the mortgage servicer under the state program for the year, and except as provided in the old notice, the old Revenue Proc 2011-55 regarding the use of 1098-MA, the statement the state administration provides to the IRS must be a single statement that separately lists the names, taxpayer ID numbers, and relevant payments amount for each homeowners. And for calendar years 2011 through 2017, those state agencies may, at their option, use Form 1098-MA in accordance with the rules given in Revenue Procedure 2011-55 to provide that information instead of filing a single statement for the calendar year. Now, as I say, this kicks this relief forward through 2017. Presumably, we're going to start getting toward the end of the period where we're going to need this, hopefully somewhere in the near future. And whether or not it continues past 2017 will be interesting to watch. But so far, it's been kicked down the road each time we've done it, as opposed to taking into account, you know, what's actually been done or getting the 1098s fixed for what's actually been paid under these scenarios. Next up, we have a case from the Western District Court of the from the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Oklahoma. This case is Green versus United States. It is 116 AFTR 2nd, paragraph 2015-5394. It's also case number CIV 13-1237-D if you want to have the docket number to go search the case under that method. The issue in question, we've seen a number of cases related to whether trusts are going to be able to claim a deduction for a charitable contribution. May I remember earlier this year, we've had a pair of cases that came up. that looked at whether or not a trust had permanently set aside funds for charitable purposes to claim a deduction under Section 642C. This is going to look at a slightly different issue, but again goes back to that Section 642C. Section 642C governs whether or not a trust or estate on a Form 1041 is able to claim a deduction. The basic rule for Section 642C1 provides that essentially for an estate or trust, a contribution, couple things must be true. Number one, it must be authorized under the trust document. And secondly, it must provide that the contribution must come from gross income. Generally, that gross income must be gross federal taxable income of the trust or estate. It does not have to be in the same year. The Supreme Court ruled that a while back, so you could actually receive the income in 1 year and make the deduction later. That's not a problem for you. Now, the question that's come into play here, though, is what happens if a trust makes a contribution of appreciated property? And that was the issue facing the court here in the Green case. In the Green case, we have a trust that one of its major assets was a partnership that holds a large number of Hobby Lobby stores. And what ends up happening in this case is that partnership kicked out a whole bunch of income to the trust over the years. The trust, with that income and distributions, used that money to purchase other properties. Eventually, the trust made charitable contributions of those properties. The trust document did allow the trustee to make charitable contributions to charities out of the trust income. So we had an authorized issue. Now, the question that's going to come into play here, though, is if the trust gives appreciated property, does the trust get a deduction for the fair market value of that property? And even more to the point, the question would become from the IRS's perspective they raised. Secondly, if the trust goes out, uses income, buys property, does that property become corpus? And then does that property for that reason, because it's state law corpus, mean that the contribution was not made from income, meaning that no deductions allowed? This case, the IRS had taken a position going back a number of years ago in 2010. If you take a look at Chief Counsel Advice 2010-42023, the IRS position that was taken in that Chief Counsel Advice was, in a situation like this, the trust could only claim a deduction for the amount equal to its basis in the property. That particular issue had never really been litigated until now. So this was the case where we're going to test that IRS Chief Counsel Advice and the issue that it took, taking the position that the trust could only take a donation, can only take a charitable contribution in a case like this for its basis. The court in this case, it is a district court case in Oklahoma, noted that Section 642 integrates Section 170. In essence, you have to apply Section 170, the traditional charitable contribution provisions, and read it in with 642. 642 modifies 170 for a trust. Now, some interesting things that are modified. We told you about the requirement it came from income. The other interesting aside is there's no limitation on the percentage contribution for a trust. Now we start taking a look at this. Now, as we say, in this case, they bought these pieces of property. The court concluded that these pieces of property, which were given to the charity, actually came out of income. They said that the property had been acquired with items that clearly were income and were includable in income by the trust in prior years. It was includable for federal income tax purposes, and then those funds with distributions from those partnerships was used to get the money that allowed the trust to purchase this property, property which later appreciated. The court also noted that generally under 170, the trust is allowed a contribution at fair market, or not to the trust, individuals are allowed a contribution at fair market value if they give appreciated property that, if sold, would generate capital gain. In this case, they concluded that by default, that's going to be the treatment we're going to take. Now, the IRS had tried to argue that, in fact, no, the general rule under tax law is, unless Congress specifically says so, we have to treat all of these things, interpret them narrowly. And unless it's clear that Congress allowed for a fair market value contribution, that the trust will not be given that. And the 642 doesn't mention that issue. The court said, normally that's correct. That's how we have to interpret it. But then the court went on and noted with a reference back to the Sixth Circuit in the Weingarten case, took the position that, in fact, with charitable contributions, because Congress has sought to encourage people to give money to charity, that in fact for charitable contributions, the test really flips the other way. In a charitable contribution context, In essence, as long as we can construe the statute to allow the taxpayer to make the, you know, to get the deduction, it should be allowed. So if Congress is silent, we're going to assume the taxpayer-friendly theory of looking at this. We're not going to go with the taxpayer-adverse theory. So the IRS went on and said, okay, let's just accept for the moment that, you know, that they should get, that there's a fair value option possible. They said, here's two problems. Number one, they said after the trust purchased the asset, that asset then became part of trust corpus. Since it was part of trust corpus, that obviously the charitable contribution did not come from income. The court said that IRS, you're confusing the state law income and corpus designations with the federal tax law gross income issue. And the court held that the proper way to look at this one is not whether or not we had corpus or principal under the trust accounting rules of the state of Oklahoma, but rather the question was, do we have something that arose from an item includable in federal gross income? The court said since this property was purchased with federal gross income, by definition, we're fine with contributing that property, even if it was technically trust corpus at the time it was contributed. The IRS said, okay, then next, here's our problem. The appreciation inherent in the property has never been recognized by the trust. As such, that appreciation has never been included in gross income. Therefore, the IRS reasoned, the trust has to be limited to basis because only the basis represents, which is what the trust paid for the property out of that distribution of income. That's the only amount that's ever been included in income. And based on that argument, the IRS concluded that, in fact, well, that's got to be your limitation. The court didn't accept that argument. It said, we're going back to the fact that Congress said that you got this extra realized amount. They're saying as long as the asset came from income, they said the asset came from income, the deduction is separate from the idea of whether or not the contribution. So the contribution of the property came from income. So we get a deduction for that. The valuation of the amount that we get is based on the general 170 rules. So we're going to be able to take a fair market value contribution. Now, there's a couple of things to note about this case. Number one, please note it is a district court case from a single district court in Oklahoma. That means it's very likely, it would seem, that the IRS may very well seek to challenge this position elsewhere. So unless you can get your case in front of the judge that heard this case in Western District of Oklahoma, and you don't live in that area, that's not going to happen, then most likely you're going to find the service is going to still claim you're limited to the basis amount. Secondly, please realize, as I said, this is the third case under 642C we have seen come down this year. It seems pretty clear the IRS has a heightened interest in large charitable contributions claimed by trust or estates. You want to make sure that you carefully follow and that everybody doing returns in your office understands the unique nature of what has to be true for a trust or estate to get a contribution deduction. While in this case the IRS lost, remember in the prior two cases we've had this year with the set-aside rule, the IRS carried both of those cases. So the service is being picky about the rules under 642C. So if you are claiming a charitable contribution on a trust or estate, you want to make very sure that you've complied with all the requirements to allow that contribution, because it certainly appears the IRS is actually examining trust returns at this point, looking at the issue of charitable contributions made by the trust or estate. Next up, we're going to take a look at some issues regarding electronic filing issues. This was brought up in Chief Counsel Advice 2015-45017, issued on November 6th. Now, what happened in this case is we have a corporate return. A corporate return for which an amendment needs to be filed. Now, this corporation was one that was required under IRS, under the rules that we have for the IRS, to have electronically filed their corporate return. They're also therefore required to electronically file their amended return. Now, they have filed the amended return on essentially the last day as the statute was closing. So this happens. What happens is that amended return went up for e-filing. It was rejected. The rejection notice comes back after the last day for filing the return on the extended due date. And because apparently they were actually at the very end of the extension. So what we had was a corporate return filed on its extended due date, an amended return filed on the last day that the amended return could be filed to be claimed, to claim the refund. So what we have was a return coming back. Under the e-file system, the IRS was not going to accept a return that was filed more than 3 years after the extended due date. So they shut down at that point. They wouldn't accept that return. Now you get your rejection notice after that date. Under Notice 2010-13, generally you have 10 calendar days to fix the problem. And if it cannot be fixed electronically, then you basically have to send a paper return to the IRS within 10 days after you get that notice from the IRS that it can't be fixed and you get permission to do it. According to the notice, you're supposed to contact the e-help desk of the IRS to discuss how to solve the problem. They're there to help you get it electronically filed. And if they conclude that electronic filing won't work, then they will give you permission to paper file the return. In this case, there's no evidence that the taxpayer or the preparer actually went through that step. Now the question becomes, did they get their amended return timely filed? The Chief Counsel's Office concludes that even though they probably should have contacted the e-help desk, reality was the e-help desk could have done nothing to get the return paper filed, get electronically filed. It would have had to be paper filed. Therefore, the Chief Counsel's Office decided that there was no harm in not contacting the e-help desk, that effectively, since the e-help desk only could have issued the permission to file paper, that for all practical purposes, the IRS systems meant that there was permission given to file a paper return in this fact pattern. Now, be very clear here. It's very important to note that at the time they got the rejection, there was no option to file an electronic return and get it fixed. This would probably rule very differently if they'd gotten a reject before the end of the time period when they could have filed electronically the amended return. In that case, it is important to note that you do need to contact the e-help desk, even if it's very clear to you there's no way this return could be paper filed. In essence, it's much better, or I should say electronically filed, it's much better to not get into this question than to get into it. In all practical purposes, if you have an amended corporate return with an entity or amended any entity type return where there is a mandated electronic filing, you want to make darn sure that you contact the help desk, document that contact, and get their specific permission to paper file the return. That will eliminate you having the risk of having to go through this issue with the office. Finally, we're going to take a look at one additional item this week. Chief Counsel email 2015-45025. It points out some of the problems we may have if we have essentially a notice requirement in Internal Revenue Code. The private delivery service system does not always substitute for certified or registered mail. In this case, what happens here? We had a property on which a lien was placed by the IRS. Under Section 7425 of the code, generally the IRS is not bound. Their lien will not be released if there is a court proceeding for which the IRS is not a party. However, there are special rules that allow the IRS, in essence, a lien to be released by a court action, like a trustee sale of the property, if the IRS receives proper notice of the action so the IRS can show up and, you know, enforce their rights. The law in question requires this, says that notice of such a sale shall be given in writing by registered or certified mail or by personal service not less than 25 days prior to the sale. In this case, the taxpayer, or I should say the party involved, used a private delivery service. The two that we can use today are UPS and FedEx. Used one of those that was listed in 7502 and the current notice as being an acceptable service. They sent the notice to the IRS. It was delivered to the IRS more than 25 days before the scheduled sale. Now the question arose, the sale went forward. Now the question arose, did the IRS's lien survive the sale? Now you might think, well, no, it shouldn't. The document got to the IRS and they used an approved private delivery service. Chief Counsel's email concluded otherwise. The Chief Counsel's email note, the 7425 only allows you to do it by registered or certified mail or by personal service. Section 7502C, that is the part that talks about private delivery services, says that if you use them, the date you gave it to him stands in for a postmark. As the chief counsel email notes, 7425 doesn't have a postmark rule. It says essentially that you've got to do it by registered or certified mail. It doesn't say if you just drop in the mailbox and it's postmarked, it's good. Therefore, they conclude that in fact, this is not subject to the rules under 7502. For that reason, and they also concluded that personal service means literally the person, you know, being personally delivered by the taxpayer to the IRS. You can't basically hire somebody to do that for you, be it UPS or FedEx. So because of that, they held that in fact, there was no, you know, there was no proper delivery. Therefore, even though the trustee sale was complete, the buyer now has the property still subject to an IRS lien. The IRS lien was not gotten rid of by the trustee sale. As you might guess, that's kind of a big negative. Now, depending upon the size of the property and how much money is involved, there may or may not be litigation that will eventually come up on this. But certainly that suggests that be very careful when you use a private delivery service. Be very careful that you use a proper one. We've mentioned that problem before. We talked about the notice that came out listing which services are allowed. But then number two, make sure that when you're using it, you have authority to use it under that rule, that it is a document for which we need the postmark rule counts under 7502. Don't just assume that all items delivered to the IRS can use a private delivery service. As we note here, the service's position is under section 7425 for notices of sales related to liens. They don't work. At least the national office believes they don't. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of November the 16th. Be sure to tune in next week for more developments. Also, our updates are posted all the time at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. That web address will also give you access to the updates and the actual source documents for all of the four items we talked about this week. So you can go read them on your own in detail, follow up, and see how they apply to your client's situation. So we'll see you again next week as we go on the week before Thanksgiving or the week of Thanksgiving. And we'll talk to you about what happens then as we'll talk about the developments that occur in the coming weeks in the area of federal taxes.